Good afternoon. This is Ken McDermott Rowe. The name of our show is In Context. I'm here with my fellow host, Gus Cantavero.
Hello, everybody. Happy Boxing Day.
And our In Context military affairs commentator, Marshawn McDermott Rowe.
Good afternoon, everyone.
You can find us at our website, incontextreport.com. And In Context is on every Monday from noon to 1 p.m., except the first Monday of the month. This being the last Monday of the month, we're going to do our traditional war report, where we review the recent developments in the global wars. We're going to talk about events that you might have picked up and might not have picked up from the corporate news. But beyond that, we're also going to try to give you some context to these events, try to analyze them and show them what they mean for you and for our country as a whole. We're going to be taking calls later in the show. We'll be announcing that number shortly. And in the meantime, please give us an email if you'd like to make a comment or ask a question. Send it to Ken at mdrtalk.org. That's Ken at mdrtalk.org. Now, we mentioned in previous show that Wesley Clark had a meeting in the Pentagon back in the fall of 2001. And General Clark, who you know was the was the commander of NATO in Yugoslavia, recounted an event where he spoke to a general in the Pentagon. The general showed him a memorandum. Now, I remind you, this is about October of 2001, shortly after the terrorist attack on the World Trade Center. And that memorandum from the Office of the Secretary of Defense said that within the next 5 years, the United States intended to conquer 7 countries. And the last and the most important country on that list was Iran, which has probably the largest reserves of fossil fuels when you combine its oil and natural gas reserves. And it appears, as we follow the events over the recent weeks, that we are moving towards a confrontation with Iran, ostensibly over their attempts to develop a nuclear bomb. And just this week, just a couple of days ago, Iran has started a major naval drill. In and around the Straits of Hormuz. And I'd like Marchand, our military affairs commentator, if you could talk a little about the significance of this Iranian naval drill and how it relates to the confrontation between Israel, the United States, and Iran, and possibly Russia.
Well, the drill itself, I mean, first of all, the Straits of Hormuz is essential to commerce as well as to our own security. Our 5th Fleet is headquartered in Bahrain, or 6th Fleet, I'm sorry, is headquartered in Bahrain, and they have to sail through the Straits of Hormuz, as does all the oil coming out of places like Kuwait and Iraq have to sail through the Straits of Hormuz. So the Iranians are demonstrating that they can close the straits if they want to. But what's significant, especially about this exercise, is the Iranians are testing their naval electronic warfare equipment. In a release from the naval headquarters in Iran, in a press release, they talked about how what they're trying to do is they're test electronic warfare equipment that will allow them to break into our GPS and break into our communications networks and basically shut down our jets and aircraft carriers and ships remotely without having to fire a shot. Now, there is evidence to support that the Iranians have this capability because they brought down our drone in a very similar way. They intercepted the GPS signal, told the drone it was lost, and landed it.
So they gave the drone phony GPS coordinates, and the drone believed the Iranian message instead of the one it was getting from some U.S. command in the United States.
Exactly. All of our networks are very heavily encrypted, with the exception of the GPS signals, because the GPS signals come from a satellite. Apparently that is – I was talking to a fellow a few nights ago, electrician, about this. He was explaining how the signal between the satellite and the drone is the weakest link in the chain. Apparently, most of our GPS signals are not encrypted.
Well, I checked with somebody, and someone who's a specialist in internet technology, information technology, and he was explaining to me, am I up high enough?
I think
I'm
so.
I'm not really coming through in the headphones very much.
You're not coming through?
No,
it might be a volume setting.
Me either.
I can hear you pretty well, though. Turn me up just a little bit.
You're coming through fine in the meter.
Okay. All right. Fine. But anyway, this guy was telling me how the civilian channel of GPS are unencrypted, but what the Pentagon uses are encrypted, not as much as what their secure communications would be, but it's still incredibly difficult to get through, but not impossible. And when I revealed to him that the Russians are working very closely with the Iranians, he said that makes a lot of sense because Russians are well known ever since the Cold War to be able to hack into just about anything, and they're very good coders.
Well, the Chinese, we know, have been working very closely with the Iranians because as soon as the drone was brought down, the Chinese sent a military delegation along with the Russians to go and inspect the drone.
And as we've mentioned before, Iran has a mutual defense treaty with Russia, and Russia has a mutual defense treaty with China. So a war between the United States and Iran would theoretically immediately bring us into a war with Russia and possibly, very likely, a war with China.
In a press release from the Chinese Foreign Ministry, the Chinese government announced that it would be willing to, quote-unquote, enter into World War III to defend Iran. Now, why would China risk a major conflict with its supposed ally? I've heard, and I'm sure many of our listeners have heard, the old excuse that, well, China needs us too much. The problem we have is that China has no oil. They have absolutely no oil. And they received most of their oil originally from Libya and from Iran. Well, and from Iraq before we invaded. Well, we've knocked off Iraq. We've knocked off Libya. And so China's only source of independent oil comes from Iran. So if we knock off Iran, where China now receives something like 80% of its oil, we will effectively control the lifeline to China. Now, I want everyone to try to imagine if there was another country that could tell the U.S., you know, we're going to shut down your supply of oil, your gas will skyrocket. Basically, we are going to shut down your country on a whim. It's a very, very scary thought.
And the name of this game is control of oil and fossil fuels and the routes to those fossil fuels. Despite the fact that our government always gins up some great ideological justification for the war, in the case of Iraq, it was about self-defense. In the case of Libya, it was a humanitarian exercise to protect the people. Right. And they're laying that same foundation in Syria now. But it's really about controlling access and about denying access to our rival, which in this case is China.
Ultimately, it's the old game of, you know, controlling in ancient times. You would control the farming land, the grazing land of your opponent. It's a similar principle. You control the oil. You control a lifeline to a nation. So that is more important to China than any amount of trade that we could give them, because we control the oil. We control their lifeline. We could shut them down.
You were saying that they got most of their oil from Libya, and now they get it from Iran. Does that also mean that Pakistan, being in the tumultuous situation with us right now, that they're going to be sending more, and also in the future Iraq, now that we're no longer directly controlling or influencing operations there on the ground?
That's something that's really interesting. Is as soon as we leave Iraq, the Iraqi government sent a delegation, and actually they sent a delegation again yesterday, according to Press TV, the Iranian news outlet. And according to Fars, another Iranian news agency, the Iraqi Ministry of Defense sent several of their top commanders to Iran for training exercises and to further coordinate their two militaries. And similarly with Pakistan, Pakistan's held tighter coordination with the Chinese. They kicked our troops out, but they've welcomed in Chinese commandos, around 500 of them.
It certainly sounds like the beginning of World War I to me. And that's what we're trying to make our listeners be aware of, is that although you're only getting bits and pieces of this information in the corporate media, things are really lining up for a major war. We should all be very concerned, and we should be looking for ways to make this not happen.
And there's nothing I can't emphasize this enough. There is nothing inevitable about this. We still have the ability to stop it. We still have the ability to turn our foreign policy around. But if we insist on a collision course with Iran, there is no denying that the Chinese and the Russians will get involved, the Russians via their treaties, the Chinese out of necessity.
Well, talk about Defense Secretary Leon Panetta's comment on CBS News on December the 20th about a red line, that Iran may be crossing a red line with respect to its nuclear. That this seems to represent, according to Debka, a very big change in U.S. policy.
And, for those of our listeners who have never heard, Debka is an Israeli intelligence newsletter, and I would greatly advise anyone who's interested in foreign affairs to visit his debka.com. One thing that's really interesting about this statement is the U.S. policy towards Iran initially was, we don't want a confrontation. We ultimately aren't ready for a war. We're cutting the force by 140,000 soldiers in the army alone. We are going to the lowest troop levels in U.S. history. I mean, unless you go back to the War of 1812. we are militarily in absolutely no position. Our economy's broke. We're in no position for a war. And the powers that be in the U.S. know that. However, in a statement, and the Israelis have made this claim before, but in a recent phone call between Ehud Barak, the Israeli defense minister, and President Obama, Ehud Barak said that, and Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, reiterated these claims, that Israel is ready and will attack Iran on its own terms and will not notify the U.S. if the U.S. doesn't want to go along, which means we will be dragged kicking and screaming into a war with Iran, whether we like it or not, because we have a mutual defense treaty with the Israelis. So what makes this complicated? So the Obama administration now decided, well, we got to go along with it, otherwise we're going to be caught unawares when war breaks out. So after this conference, Leon Panetta, the Secretary of Defense, former head of the CIA, made a statement saying that Iran has crossed a red line. Iran is achieving nuclear weapons. They haven't ceased their nuclear program. They're clearly getting within a year or less of a bomb. We have to act. And President Obama reiterated the same claims, as did General Martin Dempsey, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Martin Dempsey, by the way, not being qualified for the position, is the head of TRADOC, Training and Doctrine. And this is the guy dictating whether we should go to war with a country with a 7-million-man army.
Well, as you've pointed out before, Marshawn, the most assertive generals, the ones who are independent or critics of the administration's military policy, have been forced out.
Oh, yes. They've either been promoted out, as in the case of General Petraeus. He was made the head of the CIA, which is kind of like taking a fish out of water. You don't take a general and make him the head of the CIA, and you don't take the head of the CIA and make him Secretary of Defense. But – and General Defense Secretary Robert Gates said, I will not allow U.S. troops on the ground in Libya. He's like, you put U.S. troops on the ground in Libya, I will resign. And the reason for this is because Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, former Secretary of Defense, had been to China. He saw the Chinese unveil their first fourth-generation bomber. It's a stealth fighter bomber. I mean, this thing, it is the latest and greatest work of technology, and it's above and beyond anything we have. So Secretary of Defense Robert Gates said, you know, this isn't what we need. We don't need to be provoking a war with Iran. We need to be looking to our own security. We need to be looking to the Pacific. We need to be looking towards our national security. The Chinese have a bomber that can fly over the U.S. and hit New York while catching us unawares. But what happens to him? He is told pretty much to resign. And after he'd served through the Bush administration and the Obama administration, then all of a sudden, because of this criticism, ostensibly, is told to resign. So he resigns. Then he's replaced with Leon Panetta. No military background, no military experience, former head of the CIA, absolute bureaucrat, is put in charge. And the first thing Panetta does is reverse his policy. He immediately says, well, you know, we have to launch strikes. We have to put boots on the ground. We have to support Israel. We have to launch an attack on Iran. And similarly, they replaced General Casey with General Dempsey, who General Casey was opposed to an intervention because for tactical reasons. We are in no position. He's replaced, and General Dempsey is made head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And General Dempsey, of course, follows whatever the party line is.
So you get a yes man. And now,
isn't all this chair swapping with the heads of the departments really just about coordinating continuity of agenda here, so that you're saying basically that the Army is the CIA and the CIA is the Army?
Precisely. It's all about we're all going to be team players. We're all going to be on the same page. If you know what's good for your career, you're going to stay on this page. Otherwise,
technically, the CIA can't tell the Army what to do. They can only share intelligence. But if you take the head of the CIA and put him in head of the Army, now all of a sudden, look who's pulling all the levers.
Precisely.
But isn't it kind of ridiculous to say that we need to go to war to prevent Iran from getting the nuke when all they could do is just import it from Russia to begin with?
Well, the whole notion, honestly, of well, we have to stop them from getting the bomb. Well, I mean, so many people have the bomb. Nuclear proliferation, especially after the collapse of the Soviet Union, is so out of control. There's really the whole notion is ridiculous.
When really a nuclear weapon isn't even the worst thing that we have. We have decapitation weapons that could be launched from satellite platforms that can hit the Earth in 20 minutes and take out a Capitol building. And no one would ever see it coming. We have these Sabo rounds that we attach to these missile platforms from outer space. It's called a meteor gun, and it can actually hit the Earth at, you know, 7-time magnitude of a nuclear bomb, like being hit by a meteor. I mean, so it's ridiculous.
It's becoming obsolete.
It's just nuclear weapons are not even what's the worst thing that can happen anymore.
And it's kind of surreal.
A scare tactic.
It's kind of surreal to describe Iran as the world's greatest threat to world peace when we are fighting wars all over the world, about six wars all over the world. It's the United States that has invaded the country.
And we have enough weapons to destroy the planet 10 times over.
It's pretty crazy. But now, while the mainstream media has been has pretty much, I don't think has really followed this story very well, the seemingly the approach to war with Iran, they've covered our withdrawal from Iraq very well, and it's been portrayed as Obama fulfilling a campaign promise to end the war in Iraq. But is that really accurate? Is it we've been forced out of Iraq?
Fundamentally, we are trying to save face. I mean, realistically, as much as we might like to think we won, this is the great victory, look at the history of Iraq during the last 6 months. We said to the Iraqis, we want to keep 30,000 troops behind. And the Iraqi government hemmed and hawed and said, we don't want this. And then Muqtada al-Sadr, who's the head of the Mahdi army, he's one of the most influential religious leaders and commands an army that is merely an extension of the Iranian army. I mean, these guys fought us to a standstill at the Battle of Najaf in 2004. And, you know, anyone can look that up. And so he said that if you don't leave Iraq, we will kill the remaining U.S. troops. And the last thing Obama needs in the run-up to an election year is heavy U.S. casualties in Iraq. So the moment he looks at this, he's looking at his campaign. So he said, okay, we'll leave behind just 10,000 U.S. troops. How's that 10,000? Sadr said, no, you leave behind anyone, absolutely anyone, we will kill them. And in a statement of this, they fired mortars at one of our FOBs and killed two or three U.S. soldiers just to kind of hammer the message home. So really, we ran with our tail between our legs. But one of the things that I think is interesting is anyone who thinks that the U.S. troops, we've left Iraq, they're coming home, is insane. What they've done is, and this is in the Army Times, you can find this in any major news outlet, other than CNN and Fox, because they don't like to report bad news, the troops that are leaving Iraq are either being rerouted directly to Jordan, to the Syrian border, or they're coming back to the U.S. for a six-month rest period. Yeah, this is a six-month rest period, and then they're being redeployed to Afghanistan.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to In Context on WPKN. We're having our monthly war report. We're reviewing developments in the global wars and trying to get behind the actual facts to see what the real meaning is. And if you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a call at 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. Or drop us an email if you'd rather do that to Ken@mdrtalk.org. Ken@mdrtalk.org. Let us know what you think about this drift towards war. And I'd also be very interested, guys, to hear from people in the audience who've been involved in the peace movement in the past. Let's say I demonstrated against the war in Iraq in 2002, 2003. If they could tell us why there isn't more going on in the peace movement right now as we seem to be drifting towards a significant widening of the global wars. Maybe they know of some peace movement that are going on in our listening area that they could talk about. So if you'd like to talk about that too, we'd like to hear by calling 203-336-9756.
Guys, should I read an email?
Sure.
Oh, sure.
Okay.
This comes from Molly, who has family in Bahrain. And she says, Bahrain has hired John Yates, the former assistant commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, has been appointed to Bahrain to oversee reform of its police force after an independent report found it's responsible for human rights abuses, with John Timoney, a former head of Miami Police, to ensure its procedures meet international human rights standards. The former assistant commissioner resigned in July over accusations surrounding his handling of the phone hacking affair and his ties to Neil Wallace, the former executive at the News of the World, who later worked for the police force. Do you think Bahrain is going to see any real reform? Bahrain's people don't think so. Why has the world turned a blind eye to Bahrain?
March, could you first tell people where Bahrain is and why it's strategically significant?
Well, first, I'd like to say thank you very much, Molly, for your email. And Bahrain is significant to U.S. foreign policy because it is right off of the East Coast, get my geography right, the East Coast of Saudi Arabia. It's a relatively small island, but it houses the U.S. Fifth Fleet. And this is – it's the essential U.S. naval base off the in the Persian Gulf. It's, in fact, our only naval base in the Persian Gulf. So
geographically very significant.
Exactly, and very close to Iran. In terms of why – well, we encourage Bahrain to be kept off the news. Because if the American people knew, and that's part of what we want to do in this show, is let the American people know what their government is doing and how it's affecting the innocent people of Bahrain. We are supporting despots like King Hamad in Bahrain, the same as we supported Ali Abdullah Saleh, that butcher in Yemen, as we supported Hosni Mubarak in Egypt. We want compliant leaders with our foreign policy.
And right now there's unrest in Bahrain?
Right now there's unrest, and that's what hiring this former police commissioner for London Met. What we're trying to do is – what they're trying to do is better suppress their own people. So they're trying to get the best from the West to suppress their own independence.
Yeah, they could take a lesson from London, just put up 25 cameras on every single corner post.
Oh, King Hamad,
hire each other to watch everybody else. You know,
King Hamad has one even better. His police use terror tactics against the opposition. They fire tear gas into neighborhoods. And folks, this is why we got to be leery of things like the
– Child's play. We have microwave guns.
Exactly. That's why we got to be leary of things.
Well, they've actually killed quite a number of demonstrators in Bahrain. Right?
That's why we got to be leery of things like the National Defense Authorization Act, which authorized the military to be called out, because that's what happened in Bahrain. Bahrain is almost, unfortunately, folks, a petri dish of what we want to do here, because there's been a significant amount of – initially it started as protests, demonstrators in the streets, agitating for nothing more than the right – to free speech, the right to have their vote counted.
Mm. This is an Arab Spring that theoretically the United States should be supporting.
Oh, we haven't supported any of the Arab Springs. The only ones we have backed are folks like those in Libya and those in Syria, Wahhabi, al-Qaeda-connected organizations. Again, this is no secret either.
Right.
The head of the NTC was a member of the Islamic Fighting Group, an al-Qaeda affiliate. The head of the Syrian Free Army is a member of an al-Qaeda-affiliated organization. So we don't want –
who are now moving into Syria, which we'll get to later on.
And, exactly. And, of course, in Bahrain, didn't the Saudis send an army with our approval into Bahrain to help suppress the dissidents?
The tanks, right?
They did, but their role is not as essential as our turning a blind eye and supplying tear gas and bullets to the Bahraini police who have been shooting and murdering innocent people throughout the country. And the world has not forgotten. The rest of the world remembers. And again, that's what we're trying to do. The people who have forgotten, the American government wants the world to forget. The problem is that through the internet and through shows like this, people are going to remember. If we can create enough of an awareness of what is happening in Bahrain, maybe, just maybe, we can help to stem or at least stop the atrocities that are taking place.
So to be clear then, we're not only not supporting the revolution, but we're actually actively supporting the suppression.
Oh, of course. And it's because the people of Bahrain are predominantly Shia. Now, the Shia are inherent allies of Iran, because Iran's the only Islamic government in the world. I mean, actually Islamic government. But it is also the only Shia Islamic government. So the fear is that, oh my gosh, the people of Bahrain actually have a vote. They might ally themselves with somebody we don't like.
Right. Well, and that's why we'll lose a forward military base.
Exactly. And that's why we don't like real democracy, because, you know, might elect people that we don't like.
Right, right. It looks like we have a call, so Mark's going to take a break to answer that, since he's the only one behind the board.
Yeah, sorry, multitasking.
Thank you for calling.
You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Where are you calling from?
Fascinating program. I'm calling from Long Island.
Okay, great. Go ahead. What's your comment?
Okay. It was really fascinating. I never put it all together with the Iran and that treaty between the Russia and China, and the way it seems like we're headed towards some kind of world war.
What are your thoughts on that?
My question is, you know, if our government officials, you know, have to have drawn similar conclusions, why and who would benefit from creating such a situation?
Well, ultimately, our goal
is... I'm going to hang up so I can turn my radio back up, okay?
Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much for your call.
Thanks for the call.
All right, thanks.
Well, ultimately, the reason why we don't fundamentally want a war with Iran, but what it's about is we want to force out the Chinese influence and the Russian influence. It's a game of controlling resources, a game of hegemony. After the fall of the Soviet Union, we were the only superpower in the world, so we could afford to topple the occasional government, support somebody like Hosni Mubarak or King Hamad, and that was enough. But in Bahrain. But now, the problem is the Russians and the Chinese are edging us out. The Chinese are building their influence in countries like Sudan, Somalia, by supporting the resistance movements there. The Russians have built alliances with people like al-Assad in Syria, which is why are we knocking off Syria? They build alliances with people like Gaddafi. knocked off Gaddafi. They were building an alliance with Saddam in 2003 when we invaded. So the whole purpose right now is to force the Russians and the Chinese out. And really, we are entering the all-or-nothing gamble. This is like the buildup to World War One, or it could be argued World War Two. You have what was the once dominant superpower in the U.S. and the world, the only superpower, the United States, and now China and Russia have come into their own. And unless one of us pulls back, there is going to be an inevitable impasse, and it is going to come to an inevitable conflict because history repeats itself. This has happened a thousand times before.
It's a really good parallel with World War One, which was really about the British Empire attempting to thwart the ambitions of the rising German Empire. And then it also had to do with oil, because the Germans were very close to completing a railroad, the Baghdad to Berlin Railroad, which would have given the Germans direct access to the Persian Gulf oil, which was then just emerging as critically important to navies. It would have given the Germans access to trade in Asia, direct land routes, and it would have made the British Navy irrelevant. And the war began just as the British were putting the final touches on this railroad, because the British could not allow that to finish. And again, we see here China, the rising empire, and as always, the dominant empire tries to thwart the ambitions of the rising empire.
Exactly. And it's the ironic thing, I shouldn't say it's so funny, but it'd be farcical if it wasn't tragic. No matter how many times this has happened in history, we had never learned from our mistakes. We never seemed to know when to pull back. The Brits didn't realize that, you know, they could have avoided losing almost a whole generation if they had just conceded, we're not going to get involved in this struggle for empire.
That's right. It's such a tragedy. That's what we want to avoid. That's a whole purpose, major purpose of the show, is that this doesn't have to happen. We can learn.
We can always walk back from this. But folks, once the war starts, if we let our government bomb Iran, if we draw in the Russians, if they start conscripting our sons and daughters, because make no mistake, that's part of why they installed things like the National Defense Authorization Act, is so that we can't dissent when they decide to conscript our children. But when that happens, it's too late for us to do anything. It's too late for us to dissent. Now's the time.
You can't unpull a trigger, you know, so that's the one thing you can't take back, taking another human life.
And the dissent seems to be repressed. As soon as the bullets start, I know there were many people were protesting the war against Iraq in the winter of 2002 and 2003. But once the invasion started, the dissent evaporated because your position becomes untenable.
Well, yeah, I mean, they're masters at propaganda, and they know how to appeal to people. And, you know, there's logical arguments that are called appeal to vanity or, you know, appeal to reason, appeal to authority. And what they do is they make people feel like they're morally superior and physically superior so that they won't feel any guilt about killing someone who's a lesser human or someone who is a savage, you know. So that's why they paint them as saying, you know, cave dwellers.
And you're in a position of stabbing your own troops in the back.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
We're going to be used as cannon fodder. You know,
right.
they don't really care about whether we share in the glory. It's whether the arrogant people who, you know, actually manipulate things get what they want. And that's the one thing that's constant through history is arrogance. You know, you say we don't learn from history. Well, I think we have. We know that the people who are in charge, who seek out authority, are arrogant and self-interested.
You're listening to In Context on WPKN. This is our monthly war report. And if you'd like to join our conversation, you can reach us at 203-336-9756. Give us your questions, your comments by calling 203-336-9756.
You know, I was talking to family over a Christmas dinner the other night. Well, not over dinner. This is very inappropriate conversation for dinner. We shouldn't do this. But after dinner, we were talking about the wars and, you know, hundreds of years ago, or even as recent as 100 years ago, people living in countries that were very warlike, you know, they would actually stand to gain by going to war. You know, you'd actually get some of that booty in a sense. You know, you get your so to speak, your chests of jewels. But what do we get today? We don't get free education. We don't get cheaper energy. We don't get anything. What do we, the people, actually stand to gain by war? And I think that that might be the best argument against it for people who maybe even still have that vanity or that superiority complex.
I think that's a good point, Jess.
I think that's an outstanding point. I mean, the fact is that the British Empire, when they had an empire, it brought them an immense amount of wealth. So they said, all right, we need to sacrifice millions of our young men, a whole generation, for the empire.
Yeah.
But we first place, we're awful at empire. We're awful. We occupy a country with trillions of dollars worth of oil, and the price of gas still goes up.
Yeah, we're really bad at it. Yeah, I lost my arm and my job. Now I have to go to the VA once a week for physical therapy, and I get nothing for it.
Exactly.
At least maybe I could get a fiefdom out of it.
Exactly. We don't even give pensions to our soldiers anymore. I mean, it was a big story in the Army Times. They got rid of pensions. All we have for our troops are 401ks.
Which they can lose in the market.
Exactly. So
they're stealing the death benefits with the small type in the contract, so that the wives don't even know that they have to get the payment from the bank, because the bank could lose it at any time since it's not guaranteed.
Exactly. So I mean, that we gain virtually nothing from empire.
And of course, it's following in this longstanding imperial pattern where the dominant empire hollows out its economy. Overextending itself on war. And this is well documented in a great book by Paul Kennedy, who's a professor at Yale, called The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. And he starts with Spain and goes all the way through the British Empire, and shows how in every case they spend too much money on war and they end up going broke.
Exactly. Well, we have a caller on the air.
Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Where are you calling from?
Hey, I'm Bridgeport. How you doing?
Hi. Great. What's your comment?
I mean, the flow of information is very heavy. It's all...
that's what we specialize in.
Yeah. Well, was there some part you'd like to focus on? Because sometimes we go too fast.
A couple seconds ago, you mentioned, well, what are we, the people, getting out of it?
Yes.
It's interesting. You know, I think we, locally, what's happening is all the people that work at Sikorsky's or any of the war machines, they're getting a paycheck.
Okay, so the industrial complex.
They're tied directly into it, and if the machine stops, they can't feed their families.
But perhaps we could reevaluate the situation and actually turn all the industrial capability we have into building bridges and ships and airplanes to actually move product and merchandise and actually build things rather than destroy them.
Yeah, we could, and I think that's, you know, I was talking to my wife this morning about, you know, this 40 or 50 year cycle that we're in. I'm 58 and I remember the Yangtze War, you know, Vietnam, and
yes.
I'm a veteran, and you know, I remember all the counterculture solutions that were generated between the immediate post-war era and say like 1970. You know, alternative energy.
Yes.
You know, Bucky is building the dome. He's talking about, you know, from death to life type of technology, and
yes.
And all those things have been abandoned. Mother
right.
Earth catalog. Who reads Mother Earth catalog? I mean, no one looks at, you know, no one knows how to build a dome. And you look at the Occupy Wall Street people, and now you see the emergence of geodesic technology right there on New Haven's Green. And I think we've reached a point in the cycle uh-huh. where we can have that conversation again.
Yes.
About converting the technology from, you know, death dealing
yes.
into actually healing the planet.
Right.
But that's, you know, that's a part of the equation that I would like for you to address.
Okay, absolutely. I mean, that we could take that $1 trillion a year that we use in occupying foreign nations, and we could have a light rail, a maglev train running from New York to Los Angeles and have that built in a couple of years.
That's right. We should be having a national conversation about how we will use all of this money to rebuild America and what
right.
new technologies we should pursue.
Even
and we need to have a local conversation, because you could have a trolley in Bridgeport.
Yes.
And you could have kind of technology generate the technology, you know, convert their technology into building trolleys and
yes.
and hydrogen buses, and I mean, I think we do have to have the national conversation, but I think what's become apparent to me
mm-hmm.
is that we have to have conversations like the one you and I are having right now.
Yes, absolutely.
Have to be local, person to person.
Yes,
until it reaches a critical mass. Because otherwise it gets lost.
That's where it starts. It's nothing happens unless it starts with you and me.
Well, that's something, Ken, you were talking about to me not that long ago, was building from a local base, the importance of local government. I think, yes, you were talking about that as well.
Yeah. Caller, are you involved in politics locally?
I'm an artist. My politics are very radical, so what you're saying kind of feeds into my politics.
We apologize.
It's good. It's a good thing. I think the solutions, and I don't glorify the '60s, but I think, you know, what the reality is on the ground right now is that we have so many of the unfinished conversations from the '60s that have that manifest themselves now as conflicts, cultural conflicts that are unresolved. That I think we have to find new language, you know, new ways to connect, and that's what I. That's the kind of thing that informs my artwork. So I think I'm more cultural than political.
Okay. Now, you do raise a lot of really important elements here that we need to talk about more. And, in fact, one of the things that you started the conversation off with was the paychecks. And I almost kind of look at it as in, like, a payoff rather than a paycheck. And I think that people are more willing to go along with the death dealing, to steal a word for phrase from you, when they feel like they're getting something from it, you know? And, Ken, I think you've told me stories about people you knew, you know, worked in defense or were contractors back in the 60s, and, you know, they felt like it was a sweet ride.
Yeah.
And those contracts are guaranteed, and they pay big bucks. So, of course, they're going to buy off the most influential people.
But despite all that, the overall trend of this economy is down, and there was a very interesting report from CBS News earlier this month on the declining salaries of Americans. I don't know if you saw it, caller, but it said that one in two, this is based on census figures, one in two Americans have fallen into poverty or a near poverty income level.
Oh, yeah.
And so the economy, this system is not delivering for people.
No, and what's counterintuitive, I guess, is that, you know, and you can flip the page of your thinking just one page over, and all of a sudden you'll have a Siri system. You know, Siri is that talking personal assistant, the computer. You know, it's a personal assistant, a handheld computer that's a personal assistant.
PDA?
You know what I'm saying? So you have this sci-fi technology that anyone can pick up. Any homeboy on the corner can pick up something with a day's wages on the drug corner, swinging rock, can pick up cutting-edge technology. And at the same time, cannot go out and get a job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a disconnect there.
There's a disconnect in terms. So, how are we defining progress? Economic progress. How are we? And I think, and I don't want to be one of those people that immediately jump and beat up the liberals. I think they are morally bankrupt. But I think the progressive left has failed to make a convincing argument of what progress actually looks like.
Well, that's true, and I think that I'm libertarian here, so I don't advocate any kind of like mandated social safety net or anything like that. But on the flip side, we can look at countries like look at a contrast between Germany and Syria, say, okay? Germany has very very cheap public transportation that is superb quality. It's clean, it's fast, it's efficient, and it runs really well. You can go to Berlin for the equivalent of 10 American dollars. You can get a pass all day long to take any kind of subway, train, or bus service to go around and tour the city. Go to Syria, you can buy a loaf of bread for the equivalent of 20 American cents. How is this possible? And this is basically countries that don't occupy an empire. But you come here and everything's expensive and you can only earn $80 a day in most jobs. Where is all this money going?
Yeah, I think, see, this is where the left, I think, see, if you talk about politics, I guess by default I'm almost an Obama Democrat. With an explanation, in the first administration, and I suspect he will get a second one, but he has become almost by necessity a functionary of the system. Maybe that's what it means to be president.
Ralph Nader said that the two parties are just one monster with two heads.
Yeah, it is. It's ridiculous. But see, this is where I think the whole political, the body politic is. You're no longer going to get the solutions that really work from discussing things politically. It has to either be culturally, which I think is the most comprehensive way of categorizing things, or economic. Because it's ultimately going to come to is urban dwellers like in Bridgeport and New Haven and Stanford are going to have to link up with these farmers and make sustainable relationships. Because you're going to have to grow your own food.
You have to have local relationships.
Your own metal. because once things start, once you go to the store and your money's no good, there's no bread, you know, there's no bread to buy.
Yes.
How are you going to make bread?
I think you're right, and that's an issue we focus on at PKN. I don't know if you know, we have a show called The Organic Farmer on Thursdays.
Yeah, I listen to it.
With Richard Hill and Guy Beardsley. And yeah, I think you're right. I think the changes may come. They'll come from the bottom. They'll come through cultural changes, not necessarily party politics.
Right, but then they have to be leveraged. And this is where the technology becomes relevant, because now you can immediately leverage local conversations into a global audience immediately. And that's what happened to facilitate the Arab Spring. And people are looking at, like, well, how was that? Was it corporately? Of course it was manipulated by the culture, by corporations, because the guy that facilitated the one in Egypt worked for Google. But everybody looks at Google as a benevolent. Corporate entity, right. Which they may be. I don't know.
No.
But, <That'd be doubtful. laughs>
but what I'm saying is you can't, and this is the other thing, and I'm going to hang up, but the other thing I'd like to hear you discuss, because your other caller talked about who benefited from this scenario that you described,
mm-hmm.
and there was no mention of corporate governance.
Right, right. That's
a
really
good issue.
The
reality of the modern world.
Well, thank you so much for your calls. You really stimulated a lot of thinking at our end.
Cool.
I really appreciate
what you guys are doing, and, you know, I really love PKN. I love what you guys are doing. I'm looking forward to the 50th anniversary. It's all good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Call us back.
Bye-bye.
All right. Peace.
Peace.
He really makes a lot of good points there, and we do have to bring the conversation back to the local government, which is what we try to empower people to do, to know that you can make change. We talk about the national scene, but it's we talk about it to show the scam that it is. You know,
right.
the mainstream media focuses on the national race, so the presidency, to make people feel disempowered, so that all of their attention gets focused on the national scene or on things like the Senate race. But nobody focuses on congressional districts or your state senator, your state representatives, governor races, because that's really where you can make a difference. You know, your county commissioners, your mayors, your selectmen, those are the people who really set the policy for your town. We really have to elect people who will reject the corporate sponsorships and reject the big time corporate sponsors for presidency and things like that. So if you see the national networks endorsing a candidate, run the other way.
Well, and I think one of the things that's interesting is we seem to forget that we can – our representatives are supposed to represent us. Our representatives are supposed to represent us, but they don't. We seem to elect our congressmen and our senators, and then whatever they do, well, if we don't like them, we vote them out in a couple of years. But we forget that they're supposed to be acting upon our will. Their mandate comes from us, the American people. So we have to realize if those jerks in Washington aren't doing what we want them to do, we should elect somebody else.
Now, see, and that's key, because the caller talked about Obama and you know, the social mandate and sort of things like that. You know, the social safety net, the anti corporate establishment, you know, mentality. That describes Obama to a T, you know, because he came in a whirlwind of anti-establishment ideals, but then immediately showed his true colors in that he, embraced all the corporations. So we talked about farming locally. We talked about things like that. All the Obama administration has done is sent SWAT teams to Amish farms to, you know, to harass them about raw milk and cheese.
And that was something I didn't understand. What was that about? I read the story, but I didn't entirely understand it.
Yeah,
they
don't. What are you talking about? The Amish farmers?
The Amish farmers.
Yeah, okay.
Thing. It seems bizarre.
There's tons of stories like this out there. I mean, in California, it happens almost daily. There's a company called Rawsome Foods in California, and what they do is they actually produce coconut milk and ice cream and sorbet and things like that, and it's raw. And they got raided by SWAT teams who went in there and confiscated all this stuff, saying it was made with raw milk products that were transported across state lines, but it's all coconut. There is no dairy. They're idiots. They don't even know what they're doing. They're just harassing people. And they went to go harass these Amish farmers because people were driving across the state line to buy it from them in Pennsylvania and then bring it back to New York or New Jersey or Ohio or wherever. And so they go and they raid the Amish farmers, saying that they're taking part in interstate commerce of raw dairy products, which violates federal law. And so they, guns drawn, roll into the Amish farms and confiscate all their dairy as if they're Al-Qaeda and they're brewing, you know, milk bombs or something.
Well, of course, because we know of all those Amish militants.
I mean, like
the Buddhist militants.
Well, they don't like anybody who doesn't play by their rules or acknowledge their authority.
It's about the corporations, and our last caller raised that, and that's an issue we should address. The corporate personhood, which allows corporations to have, there be super citizens, and it's nothing our founding fathers.
And they want to make sure that you only buy products by corporations and that it doesn't catch on. They know that it's a growing movement for raw foods and homegrown farms.
So
they
right.
know that if they have to cut it off now and by threatening people with guns, that incites a stigma.
If people get off the plantation in terms of their eating,
exactly.
that's the beginning of big challenge to corporate power.
That's right. If you have a farm or you have a biodome in your backyard, they're going to come down hard on you.
That's incredible. Absolutely incredible.
So we talk about Bahrain, but it is here. It's here now, people.
Well, that's why I say Bahrain is the petri dish. They are, unfortunately for them, the living test subjects, because everything they're implementing there, the use of mercenaries. I mean, they brought in mercenaries and dressed them up as cops. And I know we've talked about the police in the U.S. Planning on doing that before, bringing in mercenaries, people like Blackwater and whatnot, to be the law enforcement, to so-called supplement the law enforcement.
I have one announcement apropos of the war. That is, there is an election coming up in Connecticut. And if you want to vote in the April 24th presidential primary, you have to be registered Republican because there's going to be no Democratic challenger to President Obama. If you want to vote in that primary, you have to change your registration to Republican by January the 24th. Sounds crazy, but that's the law in Connecticut. You have to change your party registration 3 months before the primary. So if you are interested, if you're an independent or a Democrat and you've taken an interest in the Republican candidates and you want to vote for one because you feel he really represents your views on a particular issue, you're going to have to get a change of party form. It's actually the same form you use to register as a new voter. You can get it online, and you have to get it to your town registrar by January the 24th.
Yeah, I've been talking to Democrats all over the place, and a lot of them won't change their registration just because of principle. They won't want to change to Republican. It makes them feel dirty. But on the other hand, I'm saying, and they agree with me, and so we're still talking about this, if you want to have an honest debate, someone who's going to push Obama to be honest and have a debate that actually is going to talk about anti-war principles and ending the empire, you have to elect someone in the Republican primaries who are going to push those ideals.
Right now, there is a debate in the Republican Party that doesn't exist in the Democratic Party.
Right,
over the
there
war.
Is.
And Congressman Ron Paul has raised the war issue, and he's opposed to our policy of foreign intervention. It doesn't mean that you have, if you do register Republican, you have to vote Republican in the fall. It just gives you a chance to participate, and that we just want to know, let people know that
I don't know
January
any Democrats who
the,
are happy with what Obama's done, and they're not happy that there's no one running in the primary to push him.
Yeah, there should be a challenger to Obama, so we can have a debate.
If you're not being pushed, then there's no reason for him to keep any promises.
Exactly, and I think, again, that's something we forget, is we have to look beyond the partisan party lines and look towards which candidate really has the best interests of the American people.
I'll give you a hint. It's not Newt Gingrich or Mitt Romney or Rick Perry or Michelle Bachmann or Rick Santorum.
Which, by the way, you know, when you're talking...
Or John Huntsman.
You know, we're talking Perry and Gingrich. Neither of them are on the ballot in Virginia. And I'm not sure how many of our listeners might know that, but they couldn't get on the ballot in Virginia.
Did you want to go out with some music, Marshawn? We're going to do that or no?
Well, the song's 7 minutes long, so I don't know if you actually... I won't be able to finish the song.
Well, you want to go for
that's
it?
That's okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead with it. We're going to be on in 2 weeks. If you've been listening to In Context, 12 to 1. Our website is incontextreport.com. We're on every Monday except the first Monday of the month here on WPKN. Thanks
find
for listening.
Find the podcast. Find us on Facebook. And email us your comments, and we'll read them next time. Well, we won't be on the first week in January, right?
We'll be on next on January 9th.
And then, right, and then off on the 16th. Okay.
Right. All right, folks. Stay safe. Take it easy.
See you next time.
Free minds.
Oh, my name is Francis Tolliver. I come from Liverpool. 2 years ago, the war was waiting for me after school. From Belgium on to Flanders, Germany to here. I have fought for king and country I love dear. 'Twas Christmas in the trenches, and the frost so bitter hung. The frozen fields of France were still, no songs of peace were sung. Our families back in England were toasting us that day. Their brave and glorious lads so far away. I was lying with me messmates on the cold and rocky ground, when across the lines of battle came a most peculiar sound. Says I, now listen up, me boys, each soldier strain to hear, as one young German voice sang out so clear. He's singing bloody well, you know, my partner says to me. Soon one by one, each German voice joined in harmony. The cannons rested silent, and the gas cloud rolled no more, as Christmas brought us respite from the war. God rest ye, merry gentlemen, struck up some lads from Kent. But the next they sang was Stille Nacht, to Silent Night, says I. And in two tongues one song filled up that sky. There's someone coming towards us now, the front line sentry cries.